Time to check out some books on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. After several long interviews, we're going to take a deep dive into the book bag today on Scribble. You know, when we started out, we had kind of an equal division of interview and then book reviews. And that kind of gets blown away sometimes, doesn't it?
Well, the thing is, the time goes so fast when you get somebody who's really interesting that we don't have time for books.
Yeah, well, we'll take time for books today.
All right.
I mean, it's summertime and you should be reading And I find, though, that what gets in the way of my reading books are magazines. I have a terrible time with magazines. I can't stop reading the things. And the literary journals, you know, I will spend, I get three or four of these things, and I just read all the way through them and read about books. And first thing you know, I think I've read the book already.
I know. Well, I've been a reader since I suppose I was 6 or 7 years old, and I still, if anything is handy, I'll read it, including cereal boxes.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The number of proteins and the amount of calories. I mean, I read all that stuff.
You know, that was the thing that was socially unacceptable, to read at the table. And now that it's down to just me and David, yeah, we just read. We read as we eat.
I had a professor at the University of Chicago who had, I think, three children. And one of the things that they did at dinner, there was a lectern at the end of the table, and one of them spent the entire meal reading.
Huh.
So that they not only ate, but always listened to someone reading.
Now, that sounds like monastery stuff.
Well,
that's not a bad idea.
You know, Chicago's version. I don't know. I'd like to, when I eat, I like to eat. You know, when I like to read, I have never tried it. Maybe I should try it.
Yeah, but that's, we always spread out the paper, magazine, or something to the left side, and we eat and read. You have to be careful you don't dribble food on things, but we've gotten pretty good at that. But about some books, have you read any that are...
Here's one I just came across because the title intrigued me, and I got it just because of that, but it turned out to be really interesting and provocative. It's called The Smell of Fresh Rain by Barney Shaw, S-H-A-W. It's an English guy. A writer, but not a naturalist at all, who got curious about our sense of smell. Since you hear about taste and you hear about seeing and you hear about, you know, touch and everything, but smell doesn't come in for much. And he didn't even know how smell took place. And what he uncovered as he did his research and talked to people who knew is just what an unbelievable thing it is. For instance, how evocative smells are. You can smell one small thing that you haven't smelled since you were a kid, and it'll take you back to that whole event. I mean, I'm sure you've had that experience too.
Oh, yeah. Right? Well, Proust wrote a whole, a long, long book on that.
Right.
The smell of a Madeleine took him way back right. And took us into great depths. So that's...
I got to thinking about, you know, a smell is, it's caused by just one or two molecules hitting a nerve, you know, up in your brain someplace, that every object gives off molecules. It turns out countries give off molecules. Peru smells differently from Argentina. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you live in Peru, you eventually don't smell Peru because you get used to it. But if you're coming into Peru, and that's true, when I was in Peru, Peru has a smell, and I can still recreate that smell in my mind today. And there I am back at Peru. But here's some of the smells that I started writing down the minute I started reading this book. One of the smells that is distinctive is the smell of worms on a sidewalk after a heavy rain.
Hmm.
Have you ever smelled a worm smell?
I don't know that it registered.
I used to, you know, walk to work, and I taught in East Hall at Augustana College, and there was a long sidewalk down from 38th Street to Augustana College. And this hasn't happened for years, that worms have disappeared. Yeah. But after a really heavy rain, worms would come out of the ground and seek a place where they, you know, they could breathe. And so the entire sidewalk would just be filled with worms crawling around, waiting for the rain to stop. And I can still smell that smell and bring back East Hall and all of that. My mother used to take us out in every spring to pick wildflowers. I can smell those wildflowers, particularly the columbine, for some reason or other. These are all, I suppose, nostalgic smells for me, but the milk room on my cousin's farm where the milk is stored and separated before it goes to the dealer, or the battery room where they generated their own electricity with a little windmill, and the ozone smell of that room. The whole experience of being on that farm and playing and walking the fields comes back just from that little battery smell of ozone.
Hmm. Oh, well,
so
that book really got you going.
It really did. It's good. Uh-huh. And one of the things he attempts to do, I'm not sure with such luck, is to describe smell accurately, what it is, what's going on. And it is a strange thing, you know. I mean, the eye is fairly mechanical. The eye focuses on the optic nerve, and the optic nerve sends signals. You know, the ear is pretty much mechanical all the way through until it gets into your brain. But smell doesn't have those kinds of mechanical things going on. And but at the same time, it is a powerful one of our senses.
Well, sounds like you got a book there that folks might want to read.
The Smell of Fresh Rain. It is well worth a read.
Okay. And who's the author again?
Barney Shaw.
Barney Shaw.
Yep.
Okay, well, I once again moved to the shallow end of the pool. I quite often look through catalogs of low-priced books, as I think you have that bad habit, too.
I do.
And I discovered that a whole bunch of Dave Barry's books were selling for $5 each, so I ordered about four. And most of them are just collections of his columns, which are very, very funny. But then occasionally he writes a book, and one of them was Dave Barry Hits Below the Belt. And it's all about, it's actually hits below the beltway. It's all about Washington and government and his eccentric take on it. The origins of government, or defending humanity from giant carnivorous vegetables. And the United States is born, or the spirit of freedom wakes up and smells the heifers. One of the chapters, Touring Washington, D.C., or the Many Wonders of Wingtip World. He has a mocking tone all the way through this book, but the others are collections of columns, and in all of it, Dave Barry has cultivated what I call a wonderful adolescent sense of humor. He has never grown up. When I had dinner with him, I swear, he sounds just like his columns.
Does he?
Yeah, but... Dave Barry is not making this up, and Dave Barry turns 50. Stay fit and healthy till you're dead. Dave Barry's greatest hits. Dave Barry turns 40. Dave Barry talks back. There are over 24 of them that I know in print, and you can find them in soft cover at almost any bookstore. And if you look at a used bookstore, you can probably get them at a very good price. Or check out Edward Hamilton Bookseller if you get that catalog. And that's where I scarfed up a whole bunch of them. So my recommendation would be, if you want to laugh, Dave Barry books. There are a whole bunch of them. You look them up, and I think you'll be satisfied. So back to you, friend.
Well, I've got another book that I picked up on the recommendation of my friend Don Erickson, called The Seabird's Cry. Now, you may not be interested in birds or particularly in seabirds, but this is, you know, every time I read one of these nature books that I come to it thinking, well, I've read it all already, I learn things that I never learned before. This is a book that is 10 chapters long, and each chapter covers a seabird that inhabits the coast of England, from a gull to an albatross, and it describes their world in detail, their history, their future, you know, where's the albatross going to go. But what I really got out of this book was the way in which in nature, and that includes human beings, each bird species lives in its own world. Its food, its enemies, its climate. We only notice what's needed to be noticed. So that a dog, for instance, for a dog, a door only needs to be 3 feet high. In order to train a dog to lead a blind person, the dog has to be taught that a door is really 6 feet high, because the dog does not notice that. So there are so many different worlds, and each insect, each dog, each bird has its own world. Even though they appear to inhabit the same world that we see, we're all in different worlds.
Do you you have a favorite seabird?
Do I have a favorite seabird?
Yeah.
I would guess it would be the eider duck.
Really?
And has nothing to do with the eider duck. But I read a story when I was little, probably 4 or 5. My mother must have read it to me, about taking eider ducks and picking the down and making pillows, you know, from the fluff. Mm-hmm. Which are the softest pillows in the world, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
And I never forgot that. So for me, for no reason having to do with the bird itself, it would be the eider duck.
Okay. Well, now I want to launch on to perhaps talk too long about a history of the Bible, the story of the world's most influential book by John Barton. I should start by saying that I read a lot about the Bible. I really do. And a lot of it is critiques or analyses and so on. But this is an all-encompassing book. I must say that John Barton comes to it well qualified. He has taught at Oxford for 23 years on the interpretation of Holy Scripture. He's been a minister in the Church of England since 1973. He's the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Research Encyclopedia of Religion. This book is big. There are about 489 pages in it, and let's say about 470 are text, and then 85 pages additionally of notes and then an extensive index. It's divided into four parts with a prologue and an epilogue. The four main parts are the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Bible and its texts, and then also the meanings of the Bible. And each one is divided into parts. The Old Testament about ancient Israel, its history and language, narrative, law and wisdom, prophecy, poems and psalms. Each of those gets a separate treatment. And along the way, you discover that John Barton knows everything there is to know about the Bible, its history, the different traditions. He is as learned in Hebrew tradition and religion as he is in Christianity. And he really does a marvelous job and is totally honest. I have never read a book that so carefully steers away from partisanship of any kind. It is just amazing. Part two is the New Testament, Christian Beginnings, Letters, and Gospels. Part three talks about the texts, and that's an interesting subject, how we actually got the texts and how they've been translated and actually modified over time. From books to scripture, Christians and their books, and then he goes into official and unofficial texts, and then to manuscripts, and then the theme, the meanings of the Bible, whether it has an overall theme, how it was viewed by Jews and Christians, and how those attitudes changed over time, from the early rabbis and church fathers to the Middle Ages to the Reformation and the Enlightenment. And then he concludes with a very moving chapter on the Bible and faith. I'm going to soak up some time here. I want to read a little bit just from the introduction and the conclusion. The Canadian literary critic Northrop Frye wrote of the Bible, "This huge, sprawling, tactless book sits there inscrutably in the middle of our cultural heritage, frustrating all our efforts to walk around it." In a secular age, some might think it surprising how much interest there still is in the Bible. As the celebration of the fourth centenary of the King James Version, sometimes known as the Authorated Version, in 2011 showed clearly. Even those who do not believe in Christianity continue to be fascinated by its presence. For believers, the Bible is often seen as inspired by God and having a high level of authority in matters of belief and practice. For non-believers, it is a central document of Western culture. It continues to interest many readers as a collection of major literary works. The history of these works and of how they have been disseminated and interpreted is a central part of the history of Western literature. This book tells the story of the Bible from its remote beginnings in folklore and myth to its reception and interpretation in the present day. It describes the Bible's genesis, transmission, and dissemination, and shows how it has been read and used from antiquity to the present, both in its original language and its translation. Among other things, this will, I hope, dispel the image of the Bible as a sacred monolith between two black leather covers, recapture the sense of it as a product of a long and intriguing process, and illustrate the extraordinary variety of ways in which it has been read over the centuries. You can tell from that he writes easily and fluently. And then when he gets to the conclusion on this great chapter on the Bible and faith, he quotes Austin Farrar, who said, "Of course, the most conservative of us do and must rethink the theology of the saints if we are to use it or live by it. We are bound to rid St. Paul's pages of elements which we can only regard as first century period junk. Nor is that all. The Christian conscience has acquired certain sensitivities to which the first century was a stranger. We are not going to feel with St. Paul about the sovereignty of husbands over wives or about the ethics of punishment." Those words were written in 1966 by a theologian with a reputation for doctrinal orthodoxy. But it is striking how forms of Christianity that still insist on first century period junk survive and flourish. Yet a sizable body of Christians do think that though the essence of what was taught by Paul remains authoritative, its expression was conditioned by time and should be reconsidered. This is a man of great faith and great learning, and he has written a book at great length about the Bible. And I must say, I was impressed by it. I learned a lot. I think he has read every version of the Bible there is. He has studied every school of interpretation, and he is a man of deep faith. I heartily recommend it. It's a reading project, but once I got started into it, I didn't want to put the book down. I found it absolutely fascinating. A History of the Bible, almost 2 inches in depth. The Story of the World's Most Influential Book by John Barton, B-A-R-T-O-N. You might want to check it out. And I recommend it to you too, Roald.
Well, let me recommend an additional book.
Okay.
Because you just quoted Northrop Frye in that passage that you read, and it's Northrop Frye who wrote a book about 20 years ago called The Great Code, which I think took everybody by surprise because it is his argument that that the books of the Bible all got there by accident, by politics, by all sorts of weird means, eventually by a vote by a bunch of bishops, and they all come from different sources. Very few of them are written by the person who say they wrote them, including the four Gospels, probably. And nevertheless, it's Northrop Frye's thesis in this book called The Great Code that the Bible is every book in its right place, and so that however it got there, the final design of the Bible is perfect.
Well,
it's an interesting argument for a really respected literary critic.
Well, you know, it is interesting that we cannot separate ourselves from the Bible. One of the points he makes in the book is that Christianity is, while it takes the Gospels and the whole Bible into account, it's a little bit separate from it. That Christianity has a lot of Greek in it, a lot of Greek modes of thought. And Paul was the man who simply created Christianity. Before that, the teachings of Jesus were continued by his brother James in Jerusalem as a part of Judaism. And it was Paul who really broadened it, made it into a religion, and spread it all around the Mediterranean. And it's no accident that most of it was written in Greek. So it's interesting to see this. And he says that a lot of the doctrinal differences that exist between different denominations of Christianity don't have much to do with the Bible. They have to do with things that were derived from it or that were superimposed on it. And we argue about things that aren't biblical at all. As a matter of fact, if you go back to the Gospels, what Jesus is talking about is really serving the poor.
Right.
I mean, how many Christians sell all they have and give it to the poor? Nobody. Well, I take that back. I know two or three people who come very close to that. But most of us have accommodated Christianity to the world in which we live. And we become very absolute about certain aspects of it. But the basic thought of caring for one another, and in particular the poor, you know, the Sermon on the Mount is not everybody's to-do list. And so it has changed, and yet it remains influential. It is the number one publication, I guess you could say, of the past that still occupies us. Well, we could go on forever about that, but A History of the Bible by John Barton, I think you'll enjoy reading it. It's not a quick read, but expect to spend some time but to be rewarded by it. We have a few minutes. Do you have another book?
I don't really, but I could recommend one.
Okay.
Just because I got to talking to somebody about this the other day. I conned somebody into reading E.M. Forster's Passage to India, and he called me up to thank me for it afterwards and to discuss it. And it occurred to me that one of the great little fantasies in the way of short stories that I think ever written is a short story by E.M. Forster called The Celestial Omnibus. Shelley, the poet Shelley, was kicked out of school for going up a blind alley and at one end writing with arrow pointing up and writing the words to heaven. And for that, he was kicked out of school. But this takes off on that. This takes an English family, very sophisticated, wealthy, upper class, whose kid comes in one day and says, I saw an omnibus that said to heaven. And the parents for that punish him, because you can't lie like that. Don't tell lies. That's no lie. No, there was a celestial omnibus. Well, they eventually are so angry with him, they make him memorize poetry as punishment. They memorize some of Shelley. Well, and they bring in a literary expert who poo-poos the whole idea. It turns out, however, in this story, there is a celestial omnibus which the boy travels on. And it is an absolutely, if you are a reader, if you are hooked on books, you are going to find this absolutely delightful.
The book again?
Short story, The Celestial Omnibus.
Interestingly enough, C.S. Lewis uses what you might call a celestial omnibus in what I think is his greatest book. People will differ on that. Some say Mere Christianity is his great book, but I like The Great Divorce.
Right.
The Great Divorce, I thought, was one of the most moving books I read when I was in the seminary and dedicated to studying various aspects of spirituality. And C.S. Lewis's Great Divorce just got to me more deeply and directly than almost anything else I read. And there is a celestial omnibus. It starts out with people waiting in a kind of dreary town for this bus to come along. They get on board and they are taken to a strange place where everything is more solid than they are. And it is, of course, the pastor, I guess, leading up to heaven. And their adventures and how different people react to this. It is a great lesson in morality and a wonderfully fascinating read.
In which the great punishment is isolation.
The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. And with that, I think we'll close the book bag for today, and thank you very much for your attention. We'll be back with more traditional fare next week. And at some point in the future, I think we'll take time to take a look at books in the past and books that are coming up in which you might be interested. But for now, that'll do it for this edition of Scribble.